have respect for people that do it right. Colin was one of those. Just to give you an idea of what general managers do, maybe on a particular day. Sometimes there are things that come across your desk, but I'll give you an idea of what goes on. Agents. That's a frequent topic with all GMs. Some are helpful, and some can muck it up. And we deal with agents a lot. There's a place for them in the game. For instance, Simon Buxton, about 2 weeks ago, the agency helped us sign Buxton. They had a very good idea of where he was going to go. They had a tremendous idea about his aspirations of being a major league player. They knew exactly who was in the mix for him. It worked out quite well. That's when an agent is really resourceful. There are other times that they can really cause problems. They influence their players more than their wives or families, frankly. And they're a part of the game when you deal with them. Arbitration, tough process for teams, picking who you go with. It's not pleasant to go in an arbitration room. You're dealing with people's lives. You have to say things to a player that they don't want to hear. You have to be honest. You got a panel that sometimes doesn't have very much experience and knowledge about games, statistics, and so forth. That's not exactly one of the things I like to do. Any club doesn't want to go into rooms. Sometimes it's necessary. Multi-year contracts, who do you give them to? Who do you, don't you? Why do you give them? Well, sometimes they're cost savers. You give them to people that you think can handle them, is who gets them. And sometimes you're wrong. Every club's got them, and every club's made mistakes on them, but there's something that ultimately can give you cost certainty. Amateur scouting and evaluation, we just got done with the draft. It's the most important part and piece of any year for an organization. You pretty much start and end with your area scouts. They set it up, they get you in to see the right people. They close the deal for the most part, even though agents and general managers and front offices, all of a sudden, we're a big part of that thing. But local and international, they're separate entities. We scout summer leagues, we scout showcases, we scout tryout camps, we scout everything. Players don't hide, you can't hide players anymore. It's just a fact of amateur scouting. The Scouting Bureau, I don't know if you know what that is, but it's an organization that represents all 30 teams. It's a piece to it. One of the best things they do is in the amateur world, they provide the medical schedules. You really have to know the Scouting Bureau to be able to depend on their evaluations. You got to know your scouts. If you don't know their history and whether or not they're conservative, liberal, they got a different scouting scale. There's a lot of things the Scouting Bureau provides, but it can be confusing. Professional scouting, it's one thing to scout the Gulf Coast League. It's another thing to scout the major leagues. People have to understand sometimes stats, for instance, at the major league level are certainly valid. Stats in the Gulf Coast League are worthless. You shouldn't even worry about stats in the Gulf Coast League. September scouting is different than scouting in April, May, June, July, August. Scouting in spring training is different than scouting in August. You got to be careful about scouts in March getting way out over their skis on a player. You got to be careful about scouts in September having players way up there when they haven't really done most of the year. Scouting in the Arizona Fall League, where some of you guys I see out there, that's a different story in itself. They only play 6 days a week out there, number one. Number two, there's not much travel. It's almost a country club out there. And Roland brought that league into existence. It's a tremendous league, but you gotta be careful. Players are better out there than they actually are because they don't have to play much. They play 3 or 4 times a week out there for the most part. Most players can do that. You find a guy that can play 7 days a week, you've got something. So when you're scouting professionally, you better know what you're doing. Video in the evaluation process, some people use it more than others. I don't know how people scout video in the amateur world. I just can't figure that out. I don't think many of us make decisions on video. It is a tremendous piece in the major leagues, I can tell you that. All of us use it. General managers have to manage and be accessible to the media, whether it's the print or broadcasters. Bloggers are a big piece nowadays. We get a lot of calls from a lot of people. Some are valid, some are just looking for stories, some are creditable, Some are full of it, some aren't. It's a tough thing because you want to give everybody their due. You can't answer the phone on every guy that calls wanting to do a story. If you've got a guy like Buxton, or you've got a guy like Sano that we have people calling all the time wanting a story about Sano. We just don't have the time to take it all in. I try to delegate that to our minor league people and our scouting people if you can. Payrolls are huge. Our payroll's at $100 million. I can remember 15 years ago, we were going through a season with our payroll right at $15 million. So it's changed dramatically over the years. I think the lowest payroll this year is probably somewhere around $50 million. And of course, the Yankees are the highest at $200 million, probably. I've never used payroll as an excuse. I think it is an excuse. You do and deal with the deck you're dealt, so make it work. It doesn't matter what your payroll is. Travel is a headache for all of us. We're on the road all the time. Traveling secretaries take care of most of it. Hotels, buses, facilities, all that type of stuff. It can be problematic. You've got a manager that wants one hotel. You've got your star player that wants a private suite. You've got your traveling secretary that wants a bus line. You've got to manage all that type of stuff on a daily basis. Stadium operations, we get a deal over here. Of course, anybody familiar with our organization in this market, in this facility, we had fir trees in center field we had to remove. That's something that we have to deal with. Dimensions, we got dimensions here that people aren't happy with. All that type of stuff. The general manager gets it on his plate eventually, and you have to make a decision. Affiliates, which are huge for every organization. Almost every team has 7. AAA right down through the Dominican Summer League. You have to pacify those people. We're in development and scouting for the most part in the minor leagues. The people that own those clubs are in it to make money. Don't make any mistake about it. You know, you can be a great organization and be communicative, send them wonderful human beings. If they don't have a one-loss ledger that they can sell to their fan base, they're probably going to get rid of it. Affiliates are huge for any major league organization. We deal with them every day. Medical staff, from doctors to psychologists to nutritionists to chiropractors to anybody and everybody. They're all on our staff. Every one of us have those people. They all have a separate agenda as well. They all want to look good. No one wants to have people on their DL. We are the least, or one of the least here this year, thank God. But there are teams that have 12, 13, 14 guys in the DL. It doesn't make your medical people look very good. Your strength and conditioning coordinators, when I show up, they're hiding. They don't want to be seen. That type of stuff goes on quite often. You have to pacify your business side. If an organization doesn't get along with your business side, you're probably in for a tough go. You got to be in it together. The business side, we sold all these tickets, and the baseball side is in last place like we are. You have to look those people in the eye and realize that you're in this thing together and it's not going to work in the front office. Ownership, stability. We've had the Polak family here since 84. We've got tremendous ownership. I know they take some hits, but I've heard this way too often about Carl Polak, the father. Carl was cheap, and Carl was not a good owner. That's a bunch of gibberish for me. Carl was a good owner. He was a businessman, and he was a banker. There's no doubt about that, and the bottom line was important to him. I love Carl Polak. Now his sons have taken over the club. Jim Polak's the spokesman for this team, and I do have a good relationship with Jim. He's a tremendous guy for me. They're business people, I'll grant you that, but also they're turned into baseball people. They want us to do well, and they'll help us any way they can help us to get to the point where we need to get. Most baseball teams and organizations, it goes from the top on down. If you've got a good owner and good ownership and stability up top, you're probably going to be pretty good shape, because they'll end up showing more patience than most owners. The owners that are dangerous think they know more about baseball than the baseball people. And they like to take shortcuts. That's a recipe for disaster. I don't care how you look at it or slice it. You start taking shortcuts in the game of baseball, you're going to end up taking steps back instead of forward. Statistical analysis, how to use it, that's a piece now that everybody's deep in. There's no doubt about it. It's a piece of the puzzle piece of the equation. It can be paralyzing because there's so much information available. As a decision maker, you have to take all forms of information, the scouting evaluation, the makeup, the health history, whether or not the guy can switch from the National League to the American League. Stats sometimes are invalid, sometimes they are valid. I don't get too deep into career stats. I like to look at about a year or two history. I know there are experts in this room about stats. We have experts on our staff and the organization. Some teams are deeper in it than others, but it is a piece and it's a valuable piece. As a general manager, I think it's important you keep things simple, be accessible and accountable. There isn't any hiding in this profession, in this industry. This is a tough racket. If you don't have thick skin, you might want to get into a different situation because you're going to catch it from all angles. Honesty and integrity will take you a long way as a GM. If you're honest with the other organizations, you've got a chance to make a deal. If you're one of those guys that's a con artist, not up front, trying to peddle injured goods, that stuff is going to get you in trouble, and consequently, it'll probably get you out of the GM chair quite quickly. You should hire well and delegate well as a general manager. We've got a lot of things going, but the best thing you can do is hire well and start from the area scouts. If you've got a good area scout, you better keep them and pay them, because it takes about 5 years to develop a good area scout. Your farm director, your scouting director, your roving instructors, your medical people, all those people, hire well, train well, keep them, pay them. That's the secret to having a good organization. Make the people out in the field, your scouts that are way out, your minor league people that are thousands of miles away, your people in Latin America and so forth, make them feel like a part of the organization. If they don't feel like they have a voice, there's no sense in that they're going to do a good job. They want to be a piece of this thing. They want to help you. Make sure you pick up the phone as a GM and call them every once in a while and get their input. Develop your own. I think that's one thing we've done right. You know, the last couple of years we haven't done much right, but this is one thing we do right. If you look at our staffs, we developed our manager, we developed our pitching coach, we developed our trainers, we developed our strength and conditioning people. Our farm director's been here for 45 years forever. Our scouting director and scouting's been stable. Major league coaches, front office, everything. You've got stability in an organization. You don't have to do the guesswork of what a person's thinking. For the most part, if people hang around, you know they're in it for the long haul. There's nothing worse than hiring a guy and about 2 years later, he's looking over his shoulder for another job. Get rid of him. That's a bad thing. Always looking for the next job. There's nothing I hate worse in the game than more than that type of situation. A guy will come over and whisper in your ear. He's working for a team. He's been there for 2 or 3 years. Hey, you got anything open here? I'm kind of looking around. Well, go ahead and resign and then come and talk to me. I hate that type of situation. That's why you like to hang on to people. Just a little bit about this recent draft. I wanted to talk about that. I know a lot of people like evaluation drafts. As I watched the NBA draft last night, that's an interesting scenario. It ain't the same. I can tell you that. The only thing that is quite similar, all of a sudden they're drafting a bunch of 18 and 19 year old kids. That is similar to what we do. Our 18-year-old kid went to the Gulf Coast League last week. He's 0-for-8. I'm already catching heck about drafting. The New Orleans Hornets last night drafted the kid from Kentucky, and he's probably going to be the rookie of the year. Probably have a chance to make the All-Star team. As you know, Buxton will be playing in front of 12 people in the Gulf Coast League. It's 98 degrees, humidity's 100. And he's going to take an offer, and he's going to wonder what happened. This kid's going down to the Hornets. He's going to play in front of 18,000 people a night. He's going to be making, $15 million a year, or whatever they make. Our guy's making $1,100 a month, although he got a sizable bonus. It's not the same. drafting amateur pitchers. I always got a kick out of people when they come into the draft room and how you set up the board and all that stuff. And the scout that's going to sell him to us and wants us to take him in the first round, he's got a tremendous changeup. We drafted a guy in the first round with a tremendous changeup. Number one, if you don't have a fastball to set up a changeup, it's worthless. You don't. As soon as you hear a guy start talking about a changeup in his descriptions too much, you may as well turn the page. And about the same can be said about a curveball. I don't know how many games you guys see in the big leagues, but there aren't too many curveballs that work in the big leagues. You know, Verlander's works, and there are some that do, but curveballs are, number one, hard to command and control. Two, umpires don't call curveball strikes very often, because they break too much. So don't talk about curveballs and changeups too much in an amateur pick. Let me hear about fastball velocity, fastball command, fastball movement, and usability. Mechanics, athleticism, makeup, delivery, arm action. Those are types of things you hear or want to hear when you're in the room. When you start talking about dominant pitches being the off pitches, I'm going to tell you a recipe for disaster. If you like to draft, take a lot of catchers, take a lot of left-handed pitchers, and take a lot of shortstops. You'll be in pretty good shape. Bloodlines are huge in our organization. If we see the son of a major league player, or the son of an NFL player, or the son of an NBA player, or the son of a hockey player, we're going to move him up our board. Because they've been through all the rigors of the father. They know what the headaches and heartaches and the travel, moving around, what the mother goes through, what the family goes through, treatment by agents. They have all that already. Those guys usually progress and succeed. Don't deliver or don't develop one-inning relievers. That's a mantra that I've said that to our people forever. You know, there's nothing worse than going into a minor league affiliate. You look at the stat page, and your relief pitcher's got 35 games and 35 innings. If that guy's working for us, there's a chance he's not going to be back with us, that pitching coach and that manager. We develop three-inning relievers at the very least here, or try to. I don't ever want to see a guy come up here and only be a specialist from the minor leagues, because ultimately those guys graduate into being a specialist, but we don't have to put it in their mindset that that's all they are. So with that, that's a few things on my plate and what we do daily and the thought process, and it's not as complicated maybe as you might think. And certainly in this organization, it's not. I can tell you, we try to keep things about as simple as we can. All right, yeah, let's try this one.
All right. You became a scout right after graduating from college. How did you decide you wanted to become a baseball scout?
I couldn't play. I was a left-handed pitcher back in the day, a decent high school player. I was drafted and signed by the Twins back in the early 70s, actually. I went out and I had a tremendous first year, and of course, as happens with a lot of young guys, I pretty much thought I had her clicked. I'm on my way. Nothing's going to get in my way except for myself. It did. Arm surgery, lack of stick-to-itiveness, and then the mind games start showing. Can I do this? And do I have the ability? They're all steamrolled. I always got a kick. Jim Rance is our farm director here. And Jim released me, and now I'm his boss. So Jim, a lot of times on the banquet circuit, will go, I released him. And I'm looking for him, and I said, Jim, I'm the one that fooled you. I got three more years out of you than I deserved. I waited too long. I should only play 2 years, and I played about four and a half. But I got into scouting. When I was a player, I was one of those guys that I read every box score and every stat and watched the game and subscribed to Sporting News and Baseball Digest, all that stuff back in the day. That's what I did even when I was playing. I took way too many shortcuts. I liked to do other things off the field. Believe it or not, at one time in my life, I kind of liked to chase. stuff like that. I chase a lot of things, I may have. So I developed into a scout, and I promised myself if I ever got a job, and Dale McReynolds down in southern Wisconsin got me pointed in the right direction in a lot of ways. I promised myself if I was allowed to get back in the game that I wouldn't screw it up. And of course, since 1980, I've been in the game and progressed up to be a general manager. And I've told this to the scouting people, if I can become a general manager in Major League Baseball, anybody can. Because I don't have the education, I don't have the intellect, I don't have computer skills that are great, I'm not bilingual, I don't have a lot of the things that you would attribute to successful people as general managers. I am the farthest thing away from Dave Dombrowski and Theo Epstein. I respect both of them tremendously, two of the best in the game. Everybody comes into it in a different avenue. I happen to do it this way, and it's worked well for me.
My man, recently a number of general managers have come through sort of the high-test university backgrounds as opposed to ex-player scouting and player development roles. Has this changed the business in any meaningful ways?
Well, to each their own, they got in or came into the business. There are people like Billy Beane that are major leaguers, ex-major leaguers. There are people like me that came through minor leagues. There are business people. There are sports administration people. There are farm directors that graduated to be GMs. The game has changed, not just general manager-wise. It used to be that it was always lifers. Roland's a lifer. You know, I'm kind of a lifer. We're probably the exception nowadays. It's the Harvards and the intellect and the statistical to some extent, but you look at any successful general manager, and he's going to have some of the attributes of leadership and organization and work ethic. It comes down to that. It doesn't matter where you come from, how you got in. It is a little troublesome to try to make some deals that are with people that might be stuck on something just because of their philosophy. Okay, you've got to open up. You want to make a trade, or don't you? You know, some people like to dance around and don't have much interest. Want to make a killing on a trade? You don't necessarily go into that conversation trying to make a killing. Sometimes you're just trying to shake the club. So every general manager that's in there, it's just like knowing your people. We all kind of know each other and how we operate. Some guys like to text. Some guys email. Some guys use the cell phone. Some guys won't do anything but call you on their business phone. And some guys like to do it face-to-face. It's amazing how different you go about business with each and every general manager.
Has the challenges of being a GM evolved since you became GM in 1994?
Well, back in 94, we didn't even have cell phones, frankly. You know, we didn't use cell phones back then. It has changed dramatically. I would say the media coverage is much, much different. You know, you go to Boston and New York and L.A., you're going to have 15 beat writers, 20 in that clubhouse. You come here and you might have three. That's not all that bad. One of the things people like about this organization, you don't have to go through all that media stuff on an everyday basis. The world has changed. There's no doubt about that. The game has changed. The money has dramatically changed. Back in 94, our payroll was probably, I don't know, $40 million or so. And we haven't, through the 90s, we went through a tough stretch. Things have changed so much. And probably the biggest change of all is when Camden Yards came into play. That was back about then, and almost every market nowadays has something like we have. The stadium's facilities have really been upgraded, not major league as much, maybe as minor leagues. Minor league facilities, travel, food, nutrition, all that stuff has changed to the better. You know, there used to be horror stories about minor leagues, and most of them are true. That stuff isn't so true anymore.
Have there been any GMs that you particularly liked dealing with in any end? And I suppose this would only be those no longer in the game that you didn't really like working with. Any stories you'd like to share?
Well, I've done deals with Roland. He's not the easiest guy to deal with. I can tell you, Roland's the nicest human being in the world. But as soon as you have have an injury, Roland's on the phone the next morning. Oh, it's too bad. I hate to see him. Hey, I've got a left-handed pitcher over here. Would you have any interest? And that kind of was Roland. Because you never want to get mad at the guy. He's too nice a human being. I'm ticked off. We just lost our best player. Roland's trying to pedal one of the 26 guy in his 25-man roster. I'll tell you one thing. If you want any advice about being a general manager, you don't want to get on the wrong side of another guy. You know, and the same with agents. You know, I had to go around with Jeff Morad on this Travis Lee ordeal way back in the day. Jeff Morad and I are friends. I didn't particularly like how that came down when Travis Lee was declared a free agent. But I don't think you ever want to get on the wrong side of a general manager or an agent, because you're eventually going to have to deal with them at some point. You don't ever want to close up some of your avenues on being able to make a move.
Can you talk about your decision to remain with the Twins during the contraction debate as opposed to moving to the Blue Jays or some other opportunity?
I've been here quite a long time when that opportunity started to come to the forefront. That was in 2001 or so, and I've been here since 86. But that decision, if I was to go to Toronto, and if we were contracted, I would want it. So I didn't know. As some of you might remember, we didn't even have a manager for a long time in that scenario. September, October, November, and then finally I hired Gardenhire in January. We didn't even know if we were going to play. I didn't leave because most of the people here I had hired, most of them didn't have a say. They were out in the world trying to make ends meet, and as most anybody would realize, area scouts, minor league managers, minor league coaches, rovers, you know, cooks, people that, groundskeepers, those people all are all under my umbrella. They don't make much money. The best thing they had going for them at the time were the benefits and maybe some continuity and some ability to think, okay, if I stay with the Twins for 30, 35 years, I'm going to have a fairly decent pension and a fairly decent benefit package. If I'd have left, those people were left, number one, without anybody to give them direction. But more importantly, I think this organization might have crumbled. They would have started looking. If I leave, they're going to leave, so I didn't.
Do you expect to see any impact from the new draft rules? And on what teams look for in players, primarily as regards to the new overall bonus cap?
Well, first off, there's already been a dramatic change in the draft rules because players are out playing instead of sitting there. Most of the guys that have been drafted are signed. The only thing we're waiting on are some of these guys that played in the College World Series. That's one of the best things that's happened in this draft, the change. You've got a little idea about dollars, and you know the guy's going to get out there, and we can get them going. That's good. There is a change in philosophy. If you notice, quite a few teams took college seniors. The reason they did that is to free up money to take some of these other high-ceiling guys. That is a dramatic change. We don't take college seniors much in baseball drafts. The kid that signed with the Cardinals 2 days ago, college senior, signed for 1.6. That probably wouldn't have happened before. So it is a little bit of a dramatic change here. We haven't got the ramifications on how this worked, but you saw Houston, they jockeyed around up top. They got in there on some agents. All right, how much is Appel going to cost? How much is Buxton going to cost? How much is Correa going to cost? How much is McCullers going to cost? They did all that jockeying around. We did some of that. That has helped in some points and interests. I suspect there's going to be some agent kickback here. Some of these agents are probably not too happy.
So what's it like negotiating with Scott Boras or any of the other big-time agents? Are there any stories you'd like to share?
Sometimes dealing with Scott Boras is better than others because he knows markets, he knows his players, he knows talent, he's got a stable of people around him that if it's not Scott's conversation, you can get some of his lieutenants who are more upfront than maybe because we've got a history with them. If people know this organization, we had a tough go around way back in the day when we took Veritek. This was in 94. We took him in the first round. We didn't sign him. And that was Scott Morrison representing, and that was me and Andy McPhail and Larry Corrigan. We didn't get very far. And that one's always hurt me. We've got a pretty good relationship, believe it or not, with most agents. There are agents out there that would tell you that we're terrible. But there are agents out there who tell you we're great to deal with. I think one of the things that you always want to be with an agent is honest, and don't coddle them, and don't coddle their players. All they want is honesty. If Boris calls us and asks us about our opinion about one of the players, he wants to hear what we truly believe. He doesn't want to hear jargon. Because he, more often than not, tries to help his players. He's got a scouting staff, and he's got a developmental program, probably better than most clubs, frankly. He's got some kind of operation. There's a reason he's so successful.
When evaluating a player, can you share your thoughts on the relative importance of talent, makeup, and injury history?
Well, talent's number one, there's no doubt. If you don't have talent, then you should move on. You know, those types of guys go down in the 25th, 30th rounds. Field-type players, organizational players, help make their teammates better, possible managers, scouts, rovers, instructors later on in life, people that are good baseball players. Makeup for us is probably bigger than for some. Talent, makeup, health, in that order. You know, health is big. You know, for the most part, high school kids come into the game healthy. College kids are coming into the game. You got to be careful sometimes, and I'm not ever going to take a shot at any college coach. Those guys got a tough job, man. They're trying to win, they're trying to develop, they're trying to please scouts, they're trying to please their athletic director. They got to get into the postseason. They've got a tough racket. And those players that come out of college, they are much more curious to me on health. Usually high school players are relatively healthy. They don't have too many opportunities to get to the point where they're throwing too many pitches, although that happens. But health is huge. You know, I talked recently about disabled lists. There's nothing more frustrating than disabled players. We have trouble keeping them on the field. We have trouble getting them back on the field. And we have trouble with payrolls when the majority of your high-priced guys are on the DL. Your owner, if there's one thing your owner wants to get an eyebrow raised on, is why are we on all these DL lists? Why can't we keep these players on the field? So health is a huge issue. If you can find a healthy player with skills that's got makeup, he's probably going in the first round.
Do you have any favorite players in the sense that they were just top-notch people and worked hard?
Well, I'll tell you a story. Rick Aguilar is one of my favorite all-time players. I traded him three times. That was back when we were really struggling. And we've got $20 million payroll, and we're on the verge of losing 95 or 100 games. And Rick Aguilar is out there sitting in that bullpen and hasn't pitched in a week. What am I doing? You don't need a closer for a bad club. So we traded. In fact, he walked across the clubhouse and traded him to Boston. Rick Aguilar is one of my favorite. I think it's apparent that Torrey Hunter is one of my favorite players. Accountable guy, plays hurt, energetic, doesn't duck the media. Those are favorite players. Kirby Puckett. I knew Kirby Puckett before he signed with the Twins when he was 5'7 and a half, 182 pounds. And that is a long time ago. Died way too early. You talk about a guy that has charisma and people gather around his pocket. So he'd be right up there. Radke's one of my favorite guys. He gave us 230 innings every year. Radke's the guy that signed a multi-year contract when we were on the verge of losing 95 games about the fifth year in a row. I've always appreciated that about that man. He could have went elsewhere. He stayed here and saw it through and probably was the deciding factor. Guzman and Koski and Milton and Jock Jones and Torrey Hunter and Mikhaevich and Krasinski and all those guys staying around. So I've got a soft spot in my heart for a guy like Reggie.
In the summer of your first year on the job in 1995, the Twins started poorly and you traded a number of pitchers for prospects. Do you want to talk about your thoughts and plans at that time?
Well, I've never been one and not to trade a major leaguer for a minor leaguer. You know, Joe Mays we brought over here, Kyle Loesch we brought over here. David Ortiz, of course, we brought over here. All those guys were at 8-ball. Bartlett was an 8-ball. Alexi Casillo was an 8-ball. You trade somebody and you want somebody back, go get them. And I know that Knoblauch trade was a controversial thing here. Milton was in Dallas at the time. Guzman was an 8-ball. Brian Buchanan was in the name. He was an 8-ball. I just couldn't get players back that were major league ready. It's very difficult to acquire a major league ready player. So now what are you going to do? Are you going to just let it play, or are you going to go find somebody down below? We've taken a lot of risks. Some have worked and some have not worked. I'm not one to say just because a guy's in double A, but he's, you know, it makes our fan base mad, is what it does. You go out and get minor leaguers for big leaguers. Fan base does not like that at all, and I understand that. We're trying to sell tickets. But I just trade a guy that's got 4, 5, 6 years of major league service. We've marketed the guy. He's been successful to some extent, or he wouldn't be a guy that anybody would have interest in. But I've always been of the opinion, you find somebody in rookie ball or 8-ball, if that's what we have to do, then let's go to it. I don't really like to do it because you're trying to get quick, good, quick. And that's just like picking Buxton. We could have went out and got a college pitcher. We liked Buxton better. And we liked him sizably better. So that's why we went out and got a raw 18-year-old kid that ultimately could develop into quite a player here. If he doesn't, then I'll be sitting out there listening to somebody else talk.
Be a great manager. What did you see in him, and what are some of the most important characteristics that you look for in a big league manager?
I knew Garden Hire when he was a player back with the Mets. I was over there with him, so I knew him quite well. He's a leader. He's got charisma. He's very good with the media. Players congregate around this guy. He's honest. He's got a resume as a player. He was a tremendous minor league manager. He was underneath Tom Kelly, which is a good mentor. He was good at about everything he did except be a major league player. You know, he was a marginal guy. He was a utility player. I've been around him quite a bit in my life. He hasn't changed. He's a good evaluator, which I like. That would be one of my main points of hiring a major league manager. How he delegates, what kind of coaching staff he wants to hire. He doesn't want yes guys around. He's not afraid to make a tough decision. There's nothing more important than going into a room with a player when you're telling them you're done. Gardy's got a pretty good knack of being able to handle situations like that. That's a tough game when you go in and tell a guy you're done. We're cutting. You know, we're not sending you down to AAA or AA. You're done. That's difficult. He has the ability to help in almost every way. He's very humorous. He's got a tremendous gift of gab. He can tell stories. He's got good strategy. People take a lot of shots at him about how much staff work he does or what he uses. He does a little bit more than that than people realize. So he wasn't all that difficult. I had two choices at the time, and two very good choices. We went with Gardenhire, and it's worked out.
The Twins have generally been able to build a solid bullpen relatively cheaply. What are some of the factors that go into building a strong bullpen?
Well, building a bullpen, it starts from the back forward. You've got to have somebody that's willing to take the responsibility and close the game. So consequently, that moves other people up. Everybody thought Perkins might be able to close. Well, he might, but what if he didn't? So we re-signed Capps. The Capps had a horrible year last year, and it's been well documented. He's bounced back. It's allowed Perkins to settle in. It's allowed Jared Burton to settle in. You know, going back to the day, Jeff Reardon was here, Aguilera was here, Guardado was here. We've had closers here. Even Mike Trombley, when he closed here, did a pretty good job. Hawkins for a stint. You start with that closer, then you can kind of move people up in situations that aren't so demanding. It's nice to have a balance of left and right. If you've got two or three lefties, that would help, especially when we played in the Metrodome. Guys that can pitch back to back to back, they want people that can take the ball 3 or 4 days in a row. You've got to have guys with thick skin, guys that have rubber arm, guys that throw it over. You cannot have people in the back end of the bullpen that walk people. That's just terrible. You can't put people on freebies. And we've had a little bit of that in our history. So it's, all right, here comes the evaluators. This guy, we got lucky with Burton, Wayne Kersey. Our scout, pro scout, had Burton in Cincinnati. Makeup's great. He's got a good arm, there's no doubt. He can touch 94 and 5 often. He's come up with that split change that's an outpitch to left-hand righties. Wayne said that this guy, even though he's got a history of health issues, he's worth a shot. He signed him as a non-roster guy. You take that choice anytime. Just find guys that throw strikes. They need to spin the ball a little bit. They can't be a one-pitch guy out there because you're going to expect them to maybe go two or three innings on occasion. Unless the guy pounds it in there 96, 7, and 8. We don't have many of those around here. I've taken a lot of criticism about hard throwers. We've got hard throwers. They're in the minor leagues for a reason. They don't have much pitchability yet. So I know all about hard throwers. No one wants to face a guy like Chapman throwing 101 miles an hour and not really knowing where it's going sometimes. Chapman's a, you talk about a gifted arm, he's got it. Now we turned him around the other day because he's having trouble spinning the ball. And that's going to come back, and as the season progresses, you're going to see these guys, it comes back to haunt you. You can't hide players. Eventually, it's going to show. You put a guy in, and he's shaky defensively, invariably the ball or two, the first time he's out there, is going to go right to him. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
Last question before we open it up to the floor for questions. If you could change three things in baseball, what would you change?
I love day baseball. I think we always ought to play a day game on a getaway day. I think it's unfair for a team to get home at 4 or 5, 6 in the morning and play a night game. I hate arbitration, frankly. It's probably the worst rule that the Major League Baseball put into existence because it's awkward. Real awkward. And I've been in there probably 10 times. That's not a good feeling. I'm sitting, rolling to me and you, I'm sitting across from the player and his wife. And they don't, general managers don't talk in arbitration hearings. I just sit there and listen, and when I hear something that's not accurate, which is about every other sentence, then I have to bring it to the attention of our people when we go out for recess. It's just like the court of law. I'm not a big arbitration guy. I always, and some of this was taken care of recently, but we need to get drug testing in and get drugs out of baseball. That's all. All right, let's open this thing up. Then we'll get to the meat of this order.
You had mentioned that you can't have a good changeup without a good fastball. With a guy like Drew Butera, who ended up pitching on the mound the other day with a, I believe it was a 78 mile an hour changeup and a 94 mile an hour fastball. Since he isn't locked in as a position player, has there been any trying to develop him as a bullpen?
Well, first off, you have to have the player's cooperation. He doesn't want to be a pitcher, you're wasting your time. And he doesn't want to be a pitcher. You can have a good changeup without having a good fastball. There's a lot of guys that have good changeups without good fastballs. But one plays off the other. You know, Radke lived on his changeup. We all know that here. But he also threw 90. And he also commanded the changeup. And you can throw it to right-handed hitters. But if you start changing position players to pitchers and vice versa, like Santos, Sergio Santos. We had Santos. All of us knew that he probably wasn't going to hit. But he didn't want to be a pitcher at that time in his career. After about his fourth release, and his third child, he started to see where the checks may not be coming in, and he was much more receptive to going to the mound. And what worked out. If you don't have cooperation from the player, don't even worry about it. And most of the time, when we make that conversion, we do it instructionally.
What are your good thoughts about the pitch count?
Well, there's a place for pitch counts. Certainly all of us pay attention to them, more so in the minor leagues than the major leagues. You know, we're very sensitive about pitch counts down there, because you could really abuse a guy there. You know, back in the day, AAA and AA, they were playing at 22, 23-man rosters, and finally up to 25 this year. You know how much of strain you put on a pitching staff with a 22-man roster? So you'd have to abuse pitchers in AAA and AA. We pay attention to them. They're not religion, but they are in certain parts. When you see Verlander, the best pitcher in the game, the most valuable player, he's got the body, he's got the delivery, he's got the arm action, he's got the trunk, he's got the leg strength, he's got everything where you can get him out there far. Most pitchers don't have his mechanisms to be able to do what he can do. There's a reason he can do all that stuff. The Weilmans of the world that threw 18 complete games in a season, those days are gone. We all know that. But pitch counts serve some sort of purpose, and they also make people accountable. We shouldn't abuse these guys because we got so much invested in them. But if you're telling me the other day when the guy had a no-hitter, actually Santana, our guy. He's been hurt. We all know that. There's no way that as a manager you can ask Terry Collins. And Gardy took some heat here last year, sitting slowly, because of pitch count. He had a no-hitter going into the seventh or so. We didn't want him back out there if Gardy took some kind of abuse. So you got to pick your poison on pitch counts. Go ahead.
Presently, you have two players from Hispanic players on the roster. Do the Twins actively go into the Dominican Republic and Venezuela and scout? Is that it?
Well, we're one of the most prominent teams in Venezuela. I can tell you that. And the Dominican were behind and have been behind. We have no more excuses. We had a terrible facility down there. We had to change up some things and people. We don't have any more excuses. If we don't produce for the Dominican, then it's my fault. It was my fault before, because I was part of this thing for a long time. Most of the players from the Dominican Republic that we have, we acquire and trade. That's not good. That's one of the reasons we're struggling a little bit. Well, that's a bad thing. We need to be in the other area that we're probably the most prevalent team in Australia. By far. We got more Australians under contract than we do Americans, it seems like. So, we trade off. We got a tremendous scout in Australia. That's why we're so prevalent there. We've struggled in the Dominican Republic. We've had a tremendous response in Venezuela. Venezuela's changing, I may add. The government's getting involved quite a bit down there, so you're going to have to be careful about sending in your complexes and your things that are going on down there. The government start to get involved, so it's a little different. Go ahead. Finally, I'm going to get to you.
You mentioned long-term contracts a few minutes ago. If you were the general manager of the St. Louis Cardinals, well, you sign off the rules for 10 years.
Most of those contracts don't work. Sometimes I wish I was a general manager of St. Louis Cardinals. All you got to do is look at the history of those contracts. The one guy that's done a tremendous job with that contract is Sabathia. He hasn't had any diminishing returns on the dollars versus numbers. You have to be careful with those numbers and how much a percentage you put in your payroll on one guy. There's no better example than us. You know how much money we got into Joe, how much money we got into Mono. It's a sizable chunk of our payroll. We knew it going in. We knew we were heading into Target Field. Now, some of the other things didn't go so well, but there probably wasn't a person in our organization that wouldn't have recommended us to sign Joe Mauer. Coming off of what he came off of, his youth, the way he can hit, the demand of catching. Believe me, catchers are the toughest thing to find in the game. You know, the guy at St. Louis is pretty good. The guy at Atlanta's pretty good. How many catchers? You know, there just aren't that many of them, so we signed him. We don't have any regrets. But the Pujols situation, he's 31 or 2 at the time of the contract. You got to take all that history of health, productivity, what he's like in your community, what he's like in the clubhouse, how he handles the media, whether or not a guy's going to lay down on a contract after signing it, what he's going to be like 6 years into it, more or less 10. Those are all the things that come into the equation when you start deciding who gets one of those things.
Go
What's your routine for regularly discussing things with Jim Cole? Do you meet weekly, or does he call you, or do you call him?
Well, when we're losing, it's more frequent. But it's about weekly. He comes to every game. So sometimes he'll come in. When we're doing well, he comes in more often. If we're getting shellacked like we did the other day, I won't see him. Because he might say something to me that wouldn't be too good. And that's what people do. You recognize when's the right time to approach a person. You won't ever see me go down into our clubhouse after a shellac. The last person a manager or coaching staff wants to see is a general manager. So I stay out. I'll be in there the next day, possibly to discuss a few things. I very rarely go in our clubhouse after a shellacking. And I never go in there after a tremendous win, a walk-off. Never. That's the player's domain, manager and coach's domain, the trainers, strength and weakness, the clubhouse kids. Incidentally, if you want to make good hires, make sure you get a good clubhouse manager, because they set the tone. So, I don't talk to Jim every day. I'm sure he doesn't have any interest in talking to me every day right now.
You've got a couple of years in Target Field now, and you see how it plays. It plays large.
I disagree with you there. I don't think it plays large at all.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Well, have you been over there in the last couple of weeks? It plays large for the Minnesota Twins right now. It does not play large for the opposition.
Has movement to the new field changed the way you look at who you might be drafting in terms of type of athlete or left-handed versus right-handed? Hitters, pitchers.
Absolutely. And we started that process when we were okay to get Target Field. We were more apt to draft right-handed bats right now. We certainly need people in left field and left-handed center field that can go get a ball. Hitters are hard to come by in the professional world nowadays. It's tough to find good bats. There are very few good bats in college baseball. Frankly, I hate to say that, but it's a fact that it's tough to find good, close hitters in college. So we have changed our approach. We used to draft nothing but left-handed pitchers, left-handed hitters in the double. And we certainly needed infielders that could go get a ball because we played on the cement over there. That turf was the fastest turf in the game. We needed guys with good night vision to see a ball in white robes, something like that.
Pitchers will always have a spot on the major league roster as they develop through the minor leagues. What happens when you have a situation where you've got an all-star, perennial all-star at a position player, and you've got minor leaguers coming up trying to vie for that position, and you know that it's blocked?
Well, be careful about anointing a minor leaguer, a guy that's just going to step in. It's about a 3 or 4 year ordeal for most minor leaguers. All right, Trout has stormed on, great. Harper's fine. Most guys, I got to go back to the Knobloch, maybe, that's come on the scene here and been good his first year. Most of it's a 3 or 4 year deal, not a 1 month or 2 month situation. You can always find room for players that are good on your own club, but certainly elsewhere. We did that back in the day. Dave Hollins was playing third. Todd Walker was ripping it up to the third base in Salt Lake City. Ken Herbeck was playing first. David McCarty was ripping it up in Portland. Well, you know what happened to McCarty and Todd Walker, right? Yeah. Be careful about anointing a minor leaguer and all-star before he even sets foot on a major league diamond. Not many of them develop into that type of player. So you look and see what kind of value the guy's got. You check with the industry. If you can find a home and you can make a good trade, you get that avenue. Sometimes you might be better off trading minor leaguer.
You were in the unique position of leaving the general manager's chair and then returning to it. What was different when you got back? What did you have to fix? What maybe had changed while you were away?
My biggest problem coming back is I wasn't familiar with the major leagues. I'd been gone for 3.5, almost 4 years. I hadn't seen 10 games in Target Field in that time span. I'm a little off balance. I used to know every player. I don't right now. I'm still getting acclimated. That bothers me a lot. I know a lot of minor leaguers because I've been in the minor league world. I've been in the Northwoods League. I've been in the Dominican. I've been in Japan. I've been everywhere but the major leagues. That's not a good feeling. I haven't fixed a thing. We're in the same place we were last year. So consequently, our bullpen's a little better than we were last year, but that's about it. The game's the same. Most of the people are the same. The media is much more prevalent. But that's the game. There were ball strikes, umpires, instant replay, drug testing. Some of those things have evolved over the last 4 years. I think, obviously, the draft rules have changed. International draft rules are going to change tomorrow, I may add. July 2nd is a big day. So all that stuff has changed. My lack of familiarity with some of the players in the major leagues is dramatic.
Have you removed the interim from your GM?
No, I haven't, because my wife has it. Next.
Continuity and stability in your organization. I guess my question is, how do you avoid, as an organization, becoming stale?
That is a proper and accurate statement there. You don't want people to get stale, so the more they're around, the more you got to give them. And the more you have to mention them, the more you have to expose them to areas that they might have an interest in. I do believe in that. If you've got an area scout, all right, give him pro work, give him major league coverage, give him instructional league coverage, expose him to the Arizona Fall League, expose him to winter ball. That way you can keep this guy interested in his job. If you've got a minor league manager, bring him up in September. We all get one guest coach. Expose him to the major leagues. Send him out on a scouting mission in winter ball and let him know how tough he is. Get him in the Arizona Fall League so other people can recognize his ability level. Those are the ways that you keep people from getting stale. That is about the toughest job I have. One of the reasons I left 4 years ago is I thought people were getting stale here. And it allowed Bill Smith to move up. It allowed Brad Stein to move up. It allowed Jack Coyne to move up. It allowed Joe Lutton to move up. So I took care of that by stepping aside. And I did feel some staleness start to develop with this organization. And I did something about it. I got out of the way. So I understand that. I do. I was an area scout for quite a while. And if you don't feel like you've got some upward movement when you're in your 20s or 30s, you become stale in a hurry, and you do start looking around for other opportunities. I don't want that in our organization.
Gary, how critical is it in the baseball operations side of the organization to have significant baseball experience, whether it's high school, college? There are obviously a number of cases where you have people play the game all the way to the major leagues, and some play stuff in high school.
Well, it helps your credibility. He wants to know about how an experience works in front offices and out in the field. You know, why doesn't a college coach get opportunities to manage a major league team? Right? That's kind of what we're talking about here. Or why doesn't a high school coach become a minor league manager? Well, some do, but most don't. We usually get our people from, and that way we got to develop on our own. We get most of our people from ex-minor league players that didn't have enough ability to move up the ranks. Credibility, knowing what it's like, playing the game, instincts, dealing with failure, dealing with media, all that type of stuff. You cannot expect a high school coach to be able to go into the Gulf Coast League and handle pro players without at least giving them an internship. All right, go on down there, throw batting practice, hit fungos, go into the nutrition classes, go into the English classes, go on the bus trips. All right, what are we going to do when a kid breaks down? What are we going to do if a guy gets arrested for DUI? That comes with the equation of handling people, managing people. If you don't have some sort of feel for it, then you're probably overexposing and expecting too much out of a person. But you can't get experience until you get into the fray.
Do you ever wish that you put a retractable boot on target field?
Absolutely not. No, this thing's working. As you know, we've only had one rainout this year, and it was against the Royals back on April 30th, and I had to make that call. Our business people wanted to play that game. Well, it was 31 degrees. It rained all morning. We called it at 2 o'clock, and the sun came out at 2:02. You can't win.
The only thing you would have changed then is the trees. got rid of.
Are you from here?
No, I'm not. That's where we
are. You need to sit down. Walking into the Metrodome on Sunday afternoon when it's 80 degrees out and we're sitting in the sterile Metrodome and there's 12,500 people. You're going to walk across here on Sunday. We're in last place playing the Royals that are just a tick ahead of us. We're going to have 37,000 people there just because they want to be outside. You must be from the South. Best ballpark in the country might be Seattle. I understand what you're saying. I'm making light of this thing. I do have a sense of humor. You are correct. A retractable roof wouldn't be all that bad, but it is very difficult to rain out the Minnesota Twins. It's going to have to be a typhoon. This field drains, and we're willing to wait. If it wasn't so cold that day back in April, we would have played that game, but it was freezing. That's a bad way. It's a good way to get a player hurt, actually.
Would you evaluate and comment on the Cincinnati Reds' decisions about the Rolas Jockety?
What do you want me to put Jockety under the bus here? Jockety's one of my favorite guys. About being a starter, a reliever, or a closer?
Well, what is your evaluation?
Well, I know I've seen Jockety. He's got a fastball that probably is as good as the game. He's young, he's strong, he's got a lot of energy. Command and control is an issue. Breaking ball is a little bit of an issue. People in Cincinnati, how many people are here from Cincinnati? Not too many. Most people in Cincinnati, if you read the clips the last month, were begging to get Chapman in the closer's role. The last week, things haven't gone so well. All right, now what are you going to do? I don't know what your beef is with Chapman, but I'll bet you 29 other clubs would take him off your hands.
Players like Wardle and Corey Crosby, I'd just like to know how extensively you scout in Canada.
We scout extensively in Canada. We've got full-time guys responsible for the country. We've got supervisors that we flush up in there, and we've got all kinds of bird dogs. It always helps to have Kasky and Morneau in your stable. Gave us a lot of credibility with your fine country. I believe that hitters come out of there, left-handed bats especially, and tough people, certainly with their background in hockey. So every club in the game scouts Canada. Some are luckier than others, and one of them, Cincinnati. Joey Votto has developed into one of the greatest players this game has. They did a hell of a job of scouting inside of that guy. I don't know how, because he was a first-rounder, right?
Second-rounder.
He's a second round, which okay, everybody saw him, we just missed him. If he was so great and well thought of, he'd have went up in the top couple players in the draft. But you have players up there, we just need to get in there and make sure that we don't miss them. And it's helped a lot with the showcases. A lot of the Canadian youth come down here and play in showcases.
Yesterday I was fortunate to be able to get the tour of the ballpark. Yeah, it was probably the best tour I've ever had. A number of people said that. And while taking the tour, your booth was open, and I just took a peek in, and I noticed something I thought was very curious. You had the list of the Major League ballplayer salaries on your bulletin board, and then what's in your booth. Why would you have that there?
Because when I'm evaluating the player, I want to know what he's making. And then in the cupboard up there, you didn't see, but I also have the lengths. So if I take a glance, what is that guy making? I wonder if he'd be available. And if I see, that doesn't fit, I don't have to look much farther. So I carry that. Not only do I carry it on my wall up there, it's in here. I always want to know what a guy's making because it makes a difference. Sorry, is that team going to pick up one part of the salary if you have interest in it? You know, there are certain things that I treasure, and as everybody that makes decisions know, contracts are probably one of the first things you go look at when you start discussing the trade.
Recently, that's become prominent in the baseball and MLB recently. It's a medical thing. It's come through what football is going through with the concussions. And now your organization in the Orioles, you went through Moore, Rowland, and Roberts. You got the 7-day concussions. disabled that's now in the major leagues. One is the major leagues worried about any rebound of what the NFL's having on past injured players suing them. And is this policy going throughout the minor leagues too? About the concussion?
Yes, it is. It's in the minor leagues. It's been in the minor leagues for the last 2 years, I believe. It was so important to us that they created a new disabled list, so you know how vital it is for us to get this straightened out. Thirdly, we're changing helmets next year. They're going to a more durable helmet. So the commissioner is taking this quite seriously. There isn't anybody that's been, I guess, demolished as much as we have with Bordeaux. And he has fanned for them, I understand, had one, and he was out for a sizable amount of time. I don't think anybody's concerned about suing, because some concussions are not just being hit in the helmet. A lot of them are running into fences, or no one's getting smoked by a knee. So we take it serious, and they have to be cleared by people, experts in the concussion business. It's not just our trainers and doctors. They got to be cleared before you put them back in.
Do you have any stories about Harvey Pilgrim?
Happy birthday, Harmon. He left us about a year ago. Ironically, they had a golf tournament on his behalf last year. Harmon Killebrew, I'll bet you Roland could talk about him more than I. I know Harmon and knew him well. You talk about the nicest human being for a Hall of Famer you ever want to come across is Killebrew. It's amazing his stature. He's 5'10". And in his prime, I happen to be around him a little bit in his prime, or in his waning years as a player. His back was about this wide. I mean, he hit balls that were towering. You talk about Miguel Cabrera power. That's what Killebrew possessed. You know, we played all around. I think the saddest thing about Harmon's career is he didn't spend it entirely with the Twins. He spent a short stint with the Kansas City club. Good human being, tremendous player, very accessible. You know, he was a broadcaster here. I couldn't tell you one bad word about Harmon Killebrew. That's about the best thing I can say. We have done a good job over that ballpark in honor of Harmon Killebrew. There's all kinds of stuff that has been available there.
How would you rate your minor league affiliates in comparison to other clubs in the American League? How are they doing?
Are you talking about talent or the facilities?
Both, actually. Whatever you.
Rochester is a great facility. Our talent there is just fair. New Britain is a good facility. Our talent is probably a tick above average there. Fort Myers facility is great. If you've been in spring training down there, we've got a tremendous facility. Probably one of the top five in the game. We're going to renovate that thing in the next couple of years, so it'll get up to one of the very best. Boston's got one of the best down there if you've been there. Beloit. We are in the dark ages of Beloit. Our talent is quite good there. Elizabethan has served us well. It's a glorified, smaller town, community owned. If you want to get a stitch about seeing a minor league team, go to Elizabethan. It's quite entertaining and a good place to break in a pro player, frankly. We've been there since 74. Our minor leagues, we're in the middle of the pack talent. You know, getting Buxton is going to get us up there. Getting Berrios is going to move us up there. Anytime you have a lot of top draft choices, immediately Baseball America is going to get you up there farther. We aren't horrible. We are good. That's as simple as I can put it.
Earlier you talked about the lack of good hitting in the college ranks. Is that possibly a result of the aluminum bat? And would it be a good investment for Major League Baseball provide the colleges with wooden bats?
Well, that would be a nice idea. Provide the colleges with wooden bats. And they've gone to a composite bat recently. It's brought the game back down to reality. But if you talk to college coaches, they don't want to mess around too much with wood. The offense in college baseball takes a step back. They're trying to sell that game. They're trying to get players out of high school to sign with them. So some of the, if a guy can hit with aluminum, he's probably going to hit with wood. So it's not that big a difference for evaluators. You can subtract numbers of feet on power if you want, especially when they really had those bats exploding, you know, back 5-10 years ago. They brought the bat down to reality all of a sudden. It's very similar to wood.
What's it going to take for scouts and other
Well, they recently have gone that direction. They're going to have a wing and displays and scouting reports and, you know, the Buck O'Neills of the world, Bertie Tebbets of the world, people that Roland knows better than most. But, you know, the Scout of the Year program that's been in existence for the last 20-plus years has brought scouting to the forefront. I'm always afraid to separate scouting from player development. We shouldn't just put islands on the scouts. Player development's the same, too. Minor league managers that have managed the minor leagues for 30 years, it's okay. They don't have any interest in going anywhere else. We need to identify those types of people as well.
I'm from Washington, and one of the issues, of course, that we're sort of confronting is what happens in mid-August when Strasburg reaches its limits of contention. New York is nationally still being in contention. So I'm sort of curious about the dialogue that you as a front office would have with the manager on those sorts of situations where you're concerned about a young development player and the health issues that might be involved in that, particularly with pitchers, you know, with regard to how many innings can be pitched and that sort of thing.
The only reason this has become violent is because he underwent Tommy John recently, and they're going to try to lessen the workload. Now, they got a tough balancing act there. If they're within two or three games as they go into September, they're going to shut Strasburg down. That's an organizational decision by the general manager, the owner, and the manager, the pitching coach, and the advisors. Mike Rizzo's pretty good. Mike's a good GM. Certainly David Johnson's a reputable manager, pitching coach that got experience. And with the medical people, they'll keep a close eye on Strasburg. But certainly the players are going to have some input, the agent, you know, the family. You got to get everybody's opinion. And as a GM, you ultimately got to make a decision. And that'll be interesting to follow. Obviously, you saw the game yesterday in Colorado. You know, the Rockies, their pitchers go through more than any staff in the game. So Dan O'Dowd's got a tough balancing act as well. We all do. You know, I don't have much of a problem. We aren't getting very deep in our rotation. We've got innings. You know, we've got innings here, and I'd love to see one of our guys go nine. It's not happening quite yet. Go ahead.
When do you think there'll be a female GM in Oklahoma City? It seems like they're getting closer. And do you think that a female GM will be able to do all right? And do you think this will just be accepted by all the other GMs and her team as well?
Well, whoever the first female GM that is named is going to be all right. Believe me. An owner and a president are not going to go out and stick their neck out and their job out and hire just a female to be a female. They're going to go get a baseball person. Now, Kim Ang in the commissioner's office is the most reputable as far as baseball, scouting, development, rules, contracts, major league operations, stadiums. She knows about everything and anything you need to know about being a GM. Now it's just a matter of her getting an opportunity, and I don't doubt that it won't be too far in the distant future.
What's the best trade or signing that you feel you made?
The best trade or signing is one that, believe it or not, Roland pushed me to make. Back in 2004, we lost about 13 straight going into the All-Star break. We were in first place, and we were disintegrating right in front of my eyes. I couldn't believe how much we were losing. I called Roland. I said, "Roland, we're going bad here. You know, what would you do?" He says, "I'd make a trade just to make it." I did it. I traded Kielty to Toronto and acquired Shannon Stewart. We took off. And we ended up winning. He was fourth in the MVP. That's the best trade I ever made. And I, you know, we made some decent trades. I made some stinkers. Why do you ask me about that? I got some happens. David Ortiz, I released. As soon as the federal government gives us the ability to go to Cuba, every club would be prepared to go there. Obviously, we've got one of the best resources in Tony Oliva right here. Tony goes in and out of Cuba just like we go in and out of Miami. I mean, he's very welcome. But scouts are not allowed to go to Cuba. via the commissioner's office. As soon as they open it up, you know, I don't know what Castro's feelings are. I certainly don't know what Bud's feelings are. But when they open it up, you'll see every club in the game hire an array of scouts from Cuba.
Among GMs, you have a singular connection to one club. The Twins have been here for forever. You were the GM in the 90s during a really rough run. What, during that run, did that teach you that you can now apply to the current struggles that the team is having?
The easiest way I can put that, in the 90s, we went through a horrible time. Terrible. Not block running out. Puckett with the eye, Herbeck retired. I had some sort of an agreement with Shane Mack on the plane here to take a physical. He decided to go to Japan right around the strike. Terrible. Everything that could go wrong did go wrong. We were playing in a place that no one wanted really to go in much unless we were winning. And I started searching, stay the course. Development, scouting, hire good people. Don't panic. Keep your wits about you. I'll tell you what, there's a guy back there that I got a tremendous amount of respect. Stand up, yeah. There's one of my guys back there. Yep, he's part of the 87 organization, Bob Gebhardt. He's a gentleman. Jim's probably wondering how the heck I can still see that far. The GM of the Colorado Rockies and part of their arrival into the game. Guys like him, you know, they'll give you advice. They're knowledgeable, and they got thick skin, and they kind of make up for some of the doubts you put through your mind when you're trying to do this godforsaken job.
You're not here with respect to interleague play.
Where am I with interleague play? I love interleague play. I just love it. Because you go to Pittsburgh, you go to Cincinnati, we haven't been there much. You see Andrew McCutchen, for instance. McCutchen's one of the best players in the game. He tore us up. I just do not see McCutchen do that to us. I like going to different cities. I like going to different stadiums. There's nothing wrong with National League Baseball, in our opinion, even though when we had Molitor, it's a direct disadvantage for us to go play National League Baseball. You can't play Molitor, you can't play Ortiz, but I do love interleague play. It's going to take a little turn here with the new schedule with 15 and 15. There'll be an interleague game every day. I hope they keep the national rivalries. That's my biggest concern.
We have time for about two more questions.
I am from the South.
I can't tell. Likes to see us draft local players. The most important thing with your affiliate is to give them a team, number one, that can do a decent job in the field that's competitive, but just as importantly, will represent their organization in their community, get out and about, and represent the game. It's not all about winning and losing with minor league teams. All they want is some hope and a chance. I appreciate this opportunity. Welcome to the great state of Minnesota. Philadelphia it is?
Yeah,
I might be out of work by that time.